He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears.
Our next person to interview is Colonel Joe Schweitzer. 1983 to 2006, he was an officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He was command of soldiers at the company, battalion, and brigade level to include in combat. Other assignments he had included assistant professor at the United States Military Academy, a NATO plan officer during combat operations in Kosovo, and he was also a maneuver support center chief of operations and headquarter, USACE, colonel retired. And I met Joe this last year, and he agreed to do these interviews. He experienced the wars that would be called Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And so one of the reasons that I contacted Joe about this was we want to kind of compare some of the things and how war has changed. And in some respects, it was very, very personal in Vietnam, walking through jungles and things like that. It was also personal in the Desert Shield and a Desert Storm, but it was also done quite a bit as a as an air kind of conflict. So Joe and I also, just let you know, Joe and I met at a dinner and got to talking and became friends, and he agreed to let me interview him and pick his marvelous mind for all these personal experiences. So, Joe, I've kind of given you a little bit of an introduction, but one of the things that we talked about and I'd like to ask you a little bit more about is you really came from a military family. So talk to me about how you got into the Army, why you decided to go into the Army, and some of that background.
Gladly. And first of all, Steve, thank you very much for having me and for the opportunity to share my military experience and hopefully shine a light on some of the soldiers I've served with over the decades. I'm the son of a soldier. My dad served 37 years in the United States Army. He was too young for World War II, served in the latter part of Korea, and then had 5 years in, five 1 year tours in Vietnam. And he's currently buried at Arlington. And so as a young soldier, as a young kid growing up in a, in a household with the Greatest Generation walking through our living room, I knew at a very early age that I wanted to serve in the military and in the Army specifically. And so I went to the University of Washington and graduated ROTC in 1983 and was commissioned as a lieutenant, second lieutenant in the Corps of Engineers. And I picked that branch. My dad was an armor officer, and my younger brother, 2 year groups younger than I, went on to be an infantryman. I picked that branch, I think, because, playing with Lincoln logs as a kid, I always wanted to build. And so I think that was my primary motivation for choosing the Corps of Engineers.
That kind of dates us, doesn't it? Lincoln logs.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, boy. And I had a Rector sets, that you put together.
I had that as well, with the crane and the little
yeah
metal pieces that you would bolt together. Yeah.
and all those things you could buy in the Sears catalog that are too dangerous now. I had a chemistry set, too, which was also too dangerous. I probably did two or three of the required experiments, and then I just mixed stuff together. So, and also, you mentioned your brother. Didn't you say that your brother, when we talked, that at first he was not very interested in going into the military?
Yeah, exactly. My father, if you went to college in our family, my father had one requirement, and that was that you take ROTC, one semester of ROTC in your first 2 years, because he wanted us to be exposed to the military, and he saw it more of a civic duty, you know, understanding our civics and political-military relationships, so civil-military relationships. So he wanted us to take one semester of ROTC so that we could judge the military, not vicariously through him or as a child in the military, but have our, you know, our first kind of meaningful adult experience with the military. And Marty, my brother, he refused to do it. And so he had to go to summer camp at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And that's a special program for those that didn't do, you know, ROTC in the first 2 years. You could sort of catch up and start in your junior year with, I think it was 6 weeks, at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And so Marty did that reluctantly, very reluctantly, but ended up loving it. Marty was also a college athlete. He played basketball at Old Dominion. And he saw the drill sergeants in that summer camp experience as just like his basketball coaches. And so he then, you know, went into the Army and served 30 years, retired as a brigadier general,
wow,
as an infantryman, and multiple tours. He served with me in Desert Storm. He jumped into Panama with the 2nd Battalion of the 504th Parachute Regiment in the 82nd. And then we were together in Desert Storm, and then he had multiple tours in Afghanistan.
You know, a little bit, just a side trivia piece here. I did physical reviews for accessibility on every school in Tacoma, in the Tacoma School District. And at one time, because the Tacoma School District was so close to Fort Lewis, they had, of course, they had ROTC programs in every one of the high schools. And also in every one of the high schools in Tacoma, they had a shooting range in the high school, in the basement, you know, where the ROTC folks could practice their marksmanship. And I don't think there are too many high schools now being built with gun ranges in the bottom of them. But anyhow, that's...
And as a young kid growing up, you know, on Army bases, I mean, I remember we were stationed in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania. I was like maybe 9 to 12 in that time frame. My dad was a student, a teacher, deployed to Vietnam, I think his last deployment to Vietnam. And but I remember, you know, all of our military posts, we had shooting ranges, not for the military, but for family members and, you know, not just for the military. But it was, you know, there was the whole sport, and it's an Olympic sport of marksmanship shooting with, you know, 22 caliber Anschutz long rifles and the pistols. But, you know, I grew up on those kinds of ranges. I also grew up in the military with just a fascination for history. And so as we get into this discussion, you know, I've looked at our history of warfare and how it's evolved, and sometimes how it repeats itself, or at least rhymes. You know, some of the lessons that we experience in Vietnam. We relearned in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, but look forward to, you know, shining a light on
sure.
that as well in our talk.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, another thing, too, that we discussed, and I want to, you know, kind of cover in our background here was, you know, when I was in high school in 1962 to 66, I think, and I'm not trying to diss anybody, you know, it was kind of like if you didn't have anything else to do and you didn't have, you know, you weren't going to college, you kind of went into the military, and that's kind of where the dumb guys went. And what I've learned is that education is such a major part of being involved in the military. Even this gentleman I'll be interviewing next week, who retired as a big brigadier general, he was also an attaché in Russia and spent 4 years in college in the military learning how to speak Russian fluently and learning culture and learning their ways of the military. And, you know, really in doing these interviews, it's really turned me around, you know, 180 degrees. And especially now, when you've got all these GPS and all this electronics and computer stuff, you've got to be pretty darn bright and spend a lot of time in college to do it correctly. Talk a little bit about training that you've had in the military.
You know, I think, you know, the motivation, the impetus that brings, you know, young people into the military, whether as enlisted or as an officer, is, you know, covers the full spectrum. A large portion of the military are family members, you know, children that grew up in military households and following the tradition of their mother and or father coming into the military. So, you know, regardless of your educational background in the military, one of the things I'm very proud of about our military, and this is both for the enlisted and the officer corps, is the emphasis on education. And, you know, throughout my military career, and that you can parallel this in our enlisted ranks as well, but the emphasis on education as an officer, you know, I've served 23 years in the Army, and in those 23 years, I might have, you know, 5 to 7 years in schools, whether they be military schools or, you know, traditional universities. So I'm very, very proud of that. For me personally, you know, the officer education begins with officer basic training, and they call it something else now, but it was our OBC, officer basic course. I went to the engineer officer basic course at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and that was, I think, about 6, 7, 8 months, if I remember right. And then I had Airborne Ranger School in there, and then I went on 4 years later. You go back to the engineer officer's advanced course. Again, they call it something else now, but it's yeah. pretty much the same. And then maybe 6 years after that, you do sort of your mid-career education. It was Command and General Staff College, again, called something else now, and that was at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And then I went on to the U.S. Army War College. And although not the end of our officer education, there's a capstone school for those that become general officers. I think that culminates the education system. But throughout my development as an officer in the Army, the emphasis on military and, you know, university education. I went to undergraduate at the University of Washington, as I said, and then the Army sent me to West Point to teach And in preparation to teach at West Point, I went to grad school at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and picked up two master's degrees prior to teaching at West Point. So the emphasis is significant. And you know, so, and I think its contribution to our nation, and, you know, even beyond that, the GI Bill, you look at that program that started as an outcome of World War II, the GI Bill, and significantly improved during the latest conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And
its role that it's played in the growth and success of our nation can't be understated. You know, the great corporations that came to be in the 60s and 70s, IBM, you know, et cetera, they were born out of the Montgomery GI Bill of World War II.
And you know,
CEOs.
And I was also going to say, from the Vietnam War, my mother, Dorothy, worked at Central Washington University. And her job was to work with the veterans returning from Vietnam that were on the GI Bill. And she really took that to heart and really worked hard for those veterans. And the other thing was, she mentioned this even before I heard it. She said so many, they didn't even call it PTSD then. But my mother said, in working with so many of these young men, and most of them were, you know, probably in the age of 20 to 24, right in there, she said they carried so much baggage from that war that that she tried to deal with and tried to counsel them. And you know, she did the best she could, probably didn't know too much what she was doing. And the other thing that I think about when we talk about education, with the war in Vietnam, it happened so fast. There was not a lot of time to prepare for it, number one. I mean, many kids that graduated with me in June of 66, and I can think of several, were in Vietnam by October of 66. The other thing was that Vietnam was such a unique kind of battle, and in an environment that virtually no one in the United States had been exposed to. You know, a jungle warfare and a guerrilla warfare. And I think all those things pertain too. If I look at technology right now, I would look at the military for advances in technology many times. When we think of other kinds of you know, we can certainly build bombs and we can certainly build those kinds of things. But also, doing that kind of research has also led to many technological advances. I did see one of the, a cartoon that in one of the military magazines that I get, it was, and it, had these cavemen, and the caption underneath it was the first cluster bomb, and it was in a tree, and it had a lion skin or some kind of animal skin filled with coconuts, and of course the idea was the coconuts drop on your head, but when did you what year did you go to Desert Shield, and what were you told prior to that, and how much warning did you get that was happening?
So, you know, I entered in the Army 83. Fort Carson was my first duty station. I did my lieutenant time. I went back to Fort Belvoir for my advanced course. Went to a great school at Fort Knox, Kentucky, a maintenance course before becoming the battalion maintenance officer in the 12th Engineer Battalion, 8th Infantry Division in Germany. And I arrived there in 88 and was a battalion maintenance officer for about 18 months or so. And then I took command of Delta Company, 12th Engineer Battalion. And let's see, that was maybe 89 I took command. I forget the exact month. And then, so I'd been a company commander with Delta Company, 12th Engineer Battalion, for about 18 months, and that was sort of the normal cycle. You do 18 months of company command and then, you know, go on to your next duty station and, you know, your career progression. And so it was like December of 90, December of 90. And, you know, let's back up in August of 90, that year, Desert Shield started, 2 August, and, you know, Iraq was upset with Kuwait about oil production, you know, and they had some shared fields, and Iraq accused Kuwait of stealing oil from fields that were only in Iraq, and so started that conflict, and in late July, Iraq invades Kuwait, and on 2 August, we deploy and we start Operation Desert Shield. And part of that deployment, my brother Marty, who served, he was a company commander, a fellow company commander at the same time as I, he was Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 504th Parachute Regiment in the 82nd Airborne. He deploys with the 82nd as a line in the sand, and we brought in some air assets, but it was mostly a defensive measure to, he deploys to Saudi Arabia, and it's to keep the conflict from spilling wider in the region. And really what it did is it allowed us to set conditions in the theater for sort of the second phase of a military campaign, and that's setting the theater for combat operations, which is the third phase in war campaign planning.
And we did, I was going to say, and we did, as I recall at that time too, this had kind of been, we'd been getting a lot of news in the United States about this conflict that had been going on really for a while. So I'm sure that the military planners and those that were involved at that time, you know, kind of saw some of this conflict as previews of coming attractions, for lack of a better word, that they probably knew that something was coming. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think, you know, the Middle East has been hot since at least we can go back to the overthrow of the Ottomans in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
at the
that's
beginning
right.
Around World War I time frame. And then, of course, they've had, I mean, you could go into military history, but, you know, modern Western involvement in the Middle East and concern for the Middle East at least started, and I'm sure earlier, but at least started, you know, around the time of World War I with the overthrow of the Ottomans. And then we, you know, in the 60s, of course, the tension between, you know, 48 to 73, the tension in between Israel and its neighboring states, you know, that. So we've always had sort of a keen interest and concern. You know, I remember in 73, again, living as a kid in Fulda, Germany, the real concern for having to do a non-combatant evacuation operation, the NEO, of all the family members out of Germany, because what was happening in the Middle East and the proxies with the Soviet Union and the U.S., their ties and concerns to what was happening in the Middle East. And so the Middle East has always been, remains today, great concern. And then, my take on this is, I think, we sort of diplomatically, we sort of blinked in this tension that was emerging between Iraq and Kuwait. Iraq basically came to us and, expressed their concerns with what they felt Kuwait was doing to them. And Ambassador Gillespie, who was the U.S. ambassador at the time, I think told the Iraqi government that, hey, this is between you and Kuwait. And that gave Iraq, they took that as being the permission to do what they will. And so Iraq invaded Kuwait late July, mid to late July. And then, I think we woke up diplomatically and said, this will not stand, what was happening. And of course, the way Iraq did it, they were looting and pillaging and taking, to include Americans. They took Americans hostage. I know some Bechtel employees that were taken hostage during the siege in Kuwait.
And is
so
it
the U.S.?
Is it also fair to say that, from what I know, Iraq at that point had really built up a pretty formidable military, and Kuwait was not even close militarily to Iraq.
At the time, Iraq had the fourth largest army in the world, and they had just come off 30 years of conflict with Iran. We were very concerned, going into Iraq, and preparing for combat operations with Iraq, we were very concerned about how formidable their army was, how well-trained and how experienced they were. For us, during that same 30-year period, we were involved in sort of lesser conflicts and the Cold War, and we were preparing. And I think that actually set us up very well for combat, the nature of combat in Iraq that we undertook, all of our Cold War preparation and training, that was that kind of warfare that we were actually conducting, although be it in the desert environment, vice, the woodlands of Europe. We came into Iraq, and that, again, that Desert Shield part of this operation starting in 2 August 90, that allowed us to set the conditions in the theater, and we deployed, a large portion of our army, about a third of our army at the time.
Joe, I think this is a good time when we're just getting started about the Desert Shield to break, and we've got people, thousands of people in Bashan right now on the edge of their chair waiting to hear our second part here. So let's cut this one for the box, and we will continue with the second part with Joe Schweitzer, or Colonel Joe Schweitzer, in another week. Thank you, folks. Have a great day, and we will talk to you soon. Front line, so sleep in peace.
tonight.